Hello, and thanks for joining us once again on Core Ideas, the podcast where we delve into all things related to lake sediments. My name is Adam Jezierski, and as always, I'm joined by my good friend, Josh Steampot.
Hey, how's it going, everyone?
And today, we're going to get started straight away. We don't need to discuss what we're talking about today because we've got a very special episode of the podcast for you this week, fortnight, month.
We'll see what happens when this comes out. The goal is in the next week or two from when we're recording this intro after the fact.
Yes. We have recently wrapped up our history series, a four-parter looking at the history of paleomnology. And we wrapped it up with a conversation with the man who in many ways inspired us to put that history together with Dr. John Small from Queen's University. So most of the people that listen to this podcast regularly will have heard John's name a whole bunch of times.
Even if you don't know his name, you've certainly read his name in paleolimnology papers for sure.
We referred to him a bunch, but in terms of introduction, John received his bachelor's degree from McGill University. Master's from Brock before going to do his PhD at Queen's University, where he's been a member of the faculty there since 1984. John has a long history in paleolimnology. He is the founder and co-director of the Paleoecological Environmental Assessment and Research Laboratory, or PEARL, at Queen's, which is a group of about 40 or so paleolimnologists. He has a very extensive publication record, like over 600 articles, peer-reviewed articles, and also a very extensive award record as well. And we were particularly interested in talking to John because of his standing as an officer of the Order of Canada, fellow of the Royal Society of London. He's the current president of the Academy of Science of the Royal Society of Canada. He's my boss. And we were really interested in talking about him in terms of what his thoughts were on his long history with paleomnology, really specifically in his roles both as the founding editor of JOPL, the Journal of Paleomnology, and as a former president of the International Paleolimnological Association.
Yeah, and even though he's Adam's boss, Adam didn't feel he was unable to ask the tough questions of him. And he's not my boss anymore, so I was perfectly comfortable doing that. But no, we had a nice little chat. It was something that we talked for like half an hour or so in the final edit. And we talked about a bunch of different things. What drew him to paleolimnology and a little bit about the nature of the field, sort of when he was first starting out and the changes that he's observed since. And because he's worked on some of the things we've talked about a bunch of times, like acid rain and climate change now and all of the different things, he had a really interesting perspective on sort of how paleolimnology has evolved as a science and the questions that it's addressed. So no, it was a good little run of questions and his answers.
All right. So here's our conversation now. We hope you enjoy it. So hi, John, and thanks for joining us on our
podcast. Oh, my pleasure. Yeah, my pleasure.
We've just wrapped up a series on the history of paleolimnology, in large part thanks to you, because we riffed off one of your slide decks, largely for scoping it all out. But we thought it'd be neat to talk to you about the history of paleolimnology as someone that's got some, you know, the perspective of a full career and seen it grow over the last couple decades. And up until now, until we launched Core Ideas, if you did a Google search for paleolimnology podcast, the only thing that would really come up would be you talking to the Queen's radio station about what is paleolimnology. But we've done 20 plus episodes on that topic now, so it can delve a little deeper into the behind the scenes stuff.
But which in total probably have about as many listens as that one episode.
So. Oh, a fraction. So just to begin with, like what drew you, or how did you end up encountering paleolimnology in the beginning? Like, what was your first
experience? I did my undergraduate degree at McGill University in Montreal. And there I took Yap Kalf, or now often referred to as Jacob Kalf, but his friends used to call him Yap Kalf, was the professor of limnology at McGill. And he did an upper year limnology course, which I took just out of sort of interest. I was sort of interested in ecology in general, and I was intrigued by the field. Now, in that course of, say, 36 lectures or whatever it would have been, there was maybe about 5 or 10 minutes about lake sediments and just the mention that some people have used lake sediments to reconstruct environmental change. So it really, at that point, we're talking the late 1970s here, mid to late 1970s. And it was still a very new field. Well, I wouldn't even say a new field. It just wasn't much of a recognized field at the time. So when I was finishing my bachelor's degree and I was going to start my master's at Brock University in September, there were 4 months and I thought I'd have to do some work. And they advertised a position to work at the Lake Memphremagog Field Station, which was the McGill research station where a whole bunch of limnologists did some work. And I really enjoyed that. I got the job. I was very happy to have that. And I really enjoyed it. I learned an awful lot about lakes and limnology at the time. But one thing I learned was that how noisy limnological data were. Of course, I was still a young man. I was 21 years old at the time. And I could see how the graduate students were somewhat often frustrated. Like, I've got 3 years of data, but third year was quite different from the second year. The noisiness of the data I was becoming very aware of. And I thought, well, this is just limnology. Then I went to Brock, and I was going to work on phytoplankton ecology, which was one of my interests. I just happened to be in a lab where the professor at the time, Mike Dickman, had actually a very rudimentary sediment core. And he actually was somewhat interested in paleolimnology. He had some old paper, at that point it was all photocopies hanging around. And I started reading and I got really interested in this. Though the field was, very new at the time, or very, so it's still it's very basic forms. It was mainly post-glacial, long-term, very, core sampling, what happened during the ice, after the ice age kind of thing. I thought this was a possibility. So I tried to read everything I could on the topic, and I decided to switch my topic because they had a rudimentary type core that needed some updating. And I thought that would be an interesting thing to look at. And I was also interested in environmental issues. So I was interested in the last couple of hundred years. Of course, at that time, things were still very rudimentary. This is pre-Lentutan dating, for example. But anyways, that's how I got interested in it. And the idea was, can we sort of look at long-term trends and see what information we can find there?
And were they primarily using pollen at the Brock? Was that his? I don't really know much about what they were doing, but was it sort of pollen-based, those long-term vegetation shifts? And
certainly at that time, we're talking 1970s, there was definitely pollen was king in paleo, and it was, again, long-term changes. There was some geochemistry done, wet geochemistry, and there certainly was diatom work done. There was, for example... But again, long-term, there was a group in England, Elizabeth Haworth in the UK, for example. Richard Batterby was already at UCL, a very young lecturer at University College London at the time when I was a graduate student. He was working again on long-term changes. And there were certainly groups everywhere. There was also some, on other things besides diatoms. David Fry, who was at Bloomington, Indiana, University of Indiana, he is working on fossil cladosphere. Now, he never published very many papers on fossil cladosphere, but he had already written two review articles, at least that I saw, two review articles on what paleolimnology was doing. So he was one of the first synthesizers of the field. And there were certainly others, Dan Livingston working in Africa. They were quite specialized, working on long-term changes in Africa. Dan Livingston was at Duke. There was Ed Devey working, working at this point out of Florida. There was, of course, the group, Herb Wright's group at Limnological Research Center in Minnesota. But again, these were typically long-term changes. It was also Finnish groups, Scandinavian groups, European groups. But there were sort of these little pockets of people And, you know, there were no journals dedicated to it and so on and so forth. So it's still a very nascent field at the time. And the methodology really wasn't all there. You know, we were, what was available was radiocarbon dating. And by that, we mean bulk radiocarbon dating. So it wasn't, you know, we had all sorts of issues with that. With the core, mainly a core was the Livingston type piston core. That was what you were expected to use. But there were pockets of new ideas coming here and there. But we're just talking now the late 70s. So things changed very, very quickly, especially in the later 1980s and then and onwards.
So one of the things that came up in the history of how things were swirling together, you had a couple of threads in terms of methodology developments, equipment developments, and then dating kind of put things over the edge a little bit. Do you remember when lead-210, because you would have been just... This has been right around that time. Do you remember when like lead-210 kind of like, did it explode onto the scene? And then all of a sudden, like what was the perspective at that time?
So actually when I worked at Lake Manfred Magog, Bob Flett, who now runs a consulting company that works with dating in Winnipeg, was a postdoc at the Lake Manfred Magog station. He was sort of the guy in charge of coordinating, you know, student helpers and so on and so forth. And he had a sub project looking at lead-210. It was very new at the time. It was just alpha dating at the time. And it was still being looked at as a possible dating tool. It started gaining some momentum, but it was always, you know, people criticizing, you know, our new methods come along. Certainly I knew what lead-210 dating was through my master's. It certainly was way out of my budget. It was not even a possibility. It was very expensive. Very few people would do it. Certainly by the time I was doing my graduate work, it was becoming more and more. And certainly by the time near the end of my graduate work, where we started doing acid rain work and things like that, it was definitely being used in the early acid rain work. People like Steve Norton at the University of Maine at Orono, people like Peter Appleby, people like Oldfield and Appleby were a combination coming out of Liverpool. Ed Deavy's group with people like Mark Brenner and others, Claire Shelsky in the Florida group were looking at gamma dating. And was, at that point was alpha dating of sediments using lead-210. And it was slowly coming on, but it was out there and it developed. And, but you know, it really was basically by the late 1980s where it was becoming a more standard technique.
It's pretty quick, Gary, only a decade of time to go from just something that was kicking around in postdoc world through to something that's used everywhere.
Well, you know, I really wonder, and I've said this in my keynotes and in my books that when we talk about one of the main things we do in my lab is what maybe forensic paleolimnology or the last 200 years, where would we be without lead-210 dating? I mean, we would not have dating. I'll give you a real life example. My master's thesis, one of the first attempts to try and do recent impacts, and it was on, can I determine the effects of highway construction in a park? There was this Route 30 highway going through Algonquin Park, which is a very nice natural park. But there was a significant road built in the 1930s. It was a dirt road at the time, but it went right through the park. And my feeling was, could I actually see that in the diatom record? If I can see that, you know, if I can't see that, maybe we don't have the sensitivity to do this, but I didn't have lead-210. I certainly had no budget for lead-210. It was still out there as a possibility. So here's how I did it. The data had three dates, let's say. I had the date I took the core, that was the top. I did pollen analysis, and one of the dating tools we had was ragweed or ambrosia. Ragweed appears, it's a weed that grows very luxuriantly, as you probably know, when you cut down trees. So there's a very clear, in Ontario at least, a ragweed increase about, you know, 1850s or thereabouts. So I had like 1850s where I had the ragweed rise. I had the surface, which was when I took my core, which would have been about 1978 or something, when I'm talking late 70s here. And then I had a little white line in my core, which was, we called it the Route 30 line. They really built up a lot of silt and stuff when they built the highway. And I could actually see that line. So I had that line for the highway. I had the surface. I had the bottom. I had three dates, basically, and that's how I, quote, dated the core. I know students look at it and just laugh, but I, you know, the simple reality is it's an anachronism to think this is how you should do it. If you didn't have anything else, that's all you had. In fact, my first Nature paper on acid rain did not yet have lead-210 dating.
That's something that's so interesting to me because, like, you know, everything's 2020 in hindsight. And, you know, by the time we arrived on the scene, the lead-210 and the means of getting dates are largely taken for granted. And so I'm like kind of wondering, you know, at that time, was it a case of, you know, like it seemed like a slam dunk, like the half-life is the right amount of time. Was it viewed as a slam dunk then? Or is it like, this will work, we have to figure out the details? Or is it like, we're putting all our eggs in this basket, and if this doesn't work, we don't know if we'll be able to get like dates over the last 100 years? Or were there, you know, was there a bit of a race where other isotopes being investigated? I know this is like outside of your expertise, but just in terms of the feel at the time of like pushing it over the edge.
Frank Goldfield had an article once on possible dating techniques, and he mentions he was a leader in lead-210 dating, and somewhere along the way mentions lead-210 so that as an aside, like one sentence, as I'm going by memory here, but there were a whole lot of other isotopes they were thinking that might work, which didn't really pan out. I think, you know, like most new methods, there were people criticizing it. I remember there was one conference talk saying lead-210 will move in acid sediments. It can't be used in acid lakes, but that was later shown not to be the case. I mean, you know, sometimes you didn't get good lead-210 profiles. Didn't mean it was because of the conditions. Very quickly, though, it looked like it was working pretty well because we'd had ways of maybe anchoring dates. Like we know a forest fire happened in 1945 and the date is 1945 in lead-210 and there's charcoal, for example. I'd have like a, you know, Route 30 highway white line and that would match a lead-210 date for that time. The ragweed rise. People also were looking at cesium-137. This was going to start it off mainly in England. Some of the early work was done by Winifred Pennington. Sometimes referred to as Mrs. Tootin. She often used both her husband's name and her maiden name. But she was working in the Freshwater Biological Association. She published some of the very early work on cesium-137, which of course is more like an episodic marker. But so they, you know, chronology is a key. I mean, if we're gonna pinpoint this industry caused this problem, we got to know if we're in the 1930s or in the 1980s. And so that was a major step forward. But it's an example of the methods we just use in paleolimnology. Every method we use, there was this agonizing, development of these methods. I'm even going down to the simple ways how we prepare slides and stuff. I sometimes sit in our lab and I watch students, you know, making slides. And I don't say it, but I'm sometimes watching them make the slides and I'm like, I wonder how agony went into the different ways I tried, you know, different combinations of how do I actually get them onto the, you know, onto the slide, the different combinations of acids, the how to take sediment cores, the what was available at 1970s, 1980s, how that changed, how section cores, you know, I show that in my history of paleolimnology slides, how I section cores in the late 1970s. It's not that different from like the glue sectioner, but it was, I had them onto a bookcase locked in because that's the only way I had these metal bookcases that had these holes in it where you put screws. And that's where I would put ways to hold the core with the sediment in it in a sturdy manner because it was a bookcase because it was sturdy. I use a car jack to pump it from the bottom to get it out from the top. I'd use at this point, ashtrays were everywhere. And most universities had disposable heavy tin foil ashtrays. And I found that was a very good cutting tool. So I would cut that. Things were a little more complicated. You build it. Everything was kind of from scratch. You know, you looked around a lab, which really wasn't very well supplied. So you end up using ashtrays and you end up using your car jack. it was a very different world than, you know, sending in a purchase order and getting all the equipment arriving next day via, you know, FedEx. So it was a very different world. All the methodology had to be developed and modified over the years. So it is quite different.
It's kind of like field work in the north and sometimes when you forget something and it's not there and you just have to dig around Canadian Tire until you find something that does approximately the job and like, no, that'll do.
Yeah, I think for your listeners, when you say Canadian Tire in the Arctic, what we mean is the local garbage dump. Canadian Tire is a term we often use in the high Arctic when you had a community where there are no Canadian Tires. is so the best we can actually use the hardware store, if you like, is the dump, where you walk around and look at old abandoned pieces of equipment that have been dumped, whether it be a parts of a furnace, let's say, or a part electrical unit, or you need screws. So, so I have to go to Canadian Tire, which means you go to the local dump and try and find the screw you need, because that's the closest thing we get to a Canadian Tire in many hamlets or it, where we're isolated.
Yeah, and in the same vein, because again, you know, a professor, became a professor in the early 1980s. When did you first get a personal computer?
So when I was made a, I was a professor in September 1984 is when I got my professorship. And, you know, people will be horrified now. People get startup packages of $100,000 or something. My startup package, I think, was $3,500 or something. And that's what a computer cost at the time. And it, if you, you, you know, this is WordStar 2.1 kind of thing, or 2.0. It was just that one floppy drive kind of thing. And so pretty well, my whole startup went to buy a computer, quote, quote, computer. I mean, we just laugh at it now. So that is when I got it. It was one for the lab, and it was mainly used as a text editor, though there were some, you know, some statistical programs. And other than that, it was just a fancy typewriter too, and a place to play video games, I found out with my graduate students. But but that would all be on a literal floppy. You know, they were floppy at the time. You could actually move them around, the original floppy disks. So that was my startup, was a Zenith computer. It was a Zenith computer, and they were common at the time.
Which grad student was the one who was primarily into the video games?
I can't tell you. You're a famous scientist right now. Yes, some of those first, all those first students did very well. All my students have done very well, but they were.
Okay, so that's interesting, because I would have assumed that the draw for the computer at the beginning would have been the statistical software more so than the word processing.
Well, you might say that now. Have you ever typed a thesis on a typewriter?
I have not a thesis.
So,
no.
So if you have a typo, you retype the page. So when someone makes a revision, you start from page one and you retype the entire thing over again. So trust me, people have lost concept what a typewriter was. And you, to make a copy, you know, you'd have like carbon copies, or you pay a fortune for the photocopy. But you, if you made an error, you might try whiteout. You paint it out and try and retype over it. But you would be typing and retyping and retyping, just now how we do drafts. Each one was typing typically from page one to page 47 or whatever it was.
Did the computer have a printer with it? Or
a dot matrix. All we had was dot matrix at the time. This is pre-laser printer. So it was a dot matrix. I made all this noise. It would take forever to type. And the programs were very, very, they were very primitive at the time. Even the fancy ones were primitive. There were things that have all these controls to underline something. It'd be like control KR or something, a whole combination. And to end underlining, it'd be another control KR. If you missed one control KR, the entire document would come up, for example, underlined. I think most people saw a computer as a, let's call it a text editor or a fancy typewriter. I can assure you that was it. And remember, they had very little power, those early computers. We would do like a DCA or something. We would plug it in at night with a small data set, and just one small statistical analysis. We'd come the next morning and it would still be running. Whereas now it's instantaneous. I mean, you know, this was a different world. So, and of course, and frankly, at that time, paleolimnology wasn't all that numerical either. We had like indexes for acid rain, like the alpha index, you know, the Nygaard indexes or Marilainen's work. And that was like, to get your diatoms, put this one as a, in these different categories, divide by seven or whatever, and out came a predicted pH. So that really came with the acid rain, where the numerical people especially saw these nice data sets. And they got interested for numerical or statistical reasons in these high quality data sets we could produce. And that's where that merger happened.
Okay, that's cool. I learned something already, because that's kind of just changed my perception a little bit. And you know, then leading into acid rain, and then think of it being a pretty politically charged question at the time. Was it Was it as polarized as it is today with like climate change, per se? Was it that intense?
It was polarized, but it was a much simpler problem. We didn't think it was a simple problem. Now I look back, it was the simplest problem we've had, you know, but it was definitely polarized. It was very, very similar. I've written an article, Lessons Learned from Acid Rain, and it's very, very similar. It was one of the first times that scientists were brought into, say, the media sphere in such a way with environmental issues. There was some with eutrophication earlier on, but acid rain was eutrophication more a local issue, or there was some international issues there. But acid rain was a real international issue. It was a transboundary issue. The atmosphere doesn't have a passport, and people polluting in one area were getting the financial gains of that pollution, but the pollution was going somewhere else and falling down where people weren't gaining, and it was really becoming a political and an international problem, and polarized. And very similar questions posed, and the things were, have lakes acidified? If so, when, by how much, and who? What's the cause? It was quite straightforward. You can go and show lakes are acid. All you do now is take the pH, and you can say, yeah, lakes in the Adirondacks are acid, lakes in Algonquin Park are acid, lakes in Sudbury are acid. That no one could deny the current state. What was denied is what caused it. Are they naturally acid? And many industries that were the fingers pointing are causing the acid rain were arguing that the lakes were naturally acid. And so how do you do that? Well, Sorensen only invented pH in 1909, and no one was taking the pH of the lakes in the 1800s. There wasn't even a pH function, let alone taking pH in the 1940s or anything. And so you had to show that the lakes were not naturally acid. That was a key cause. And so the way you could do that is with paleolimnology and diatoms. And that's where that whole field developed, then with chrysophytes and other indicators. And so paleolimnology really became, into headlines, literally into headlines at that time. It was a baptism of fire for someone. I was a young man at the time, of getting into the media and into controversial media with people who did not want to hear what you were saying and did not believe what you were saying, or said they did not believe what you were saying. So it really was a baptism of fire at the time. And it was kind of practice for now. It's the same arguments, you know, what I just said about acid rain. Doesn't that sound familiar with global warming? Is the earth warming? If so, when, by how much, who's the cause? And of course, global warming is a far, far more serious problem and a far more international and global problem. So it's much harder one to deal with.
Yeah, and complicated. Just, but the sea level's not rising here.
Yeah, right. Well, it's acid rain too. Why are not these lakes not acid? Yeah. Well, because they're because of geology and a whole bunch of, and there were a few naturally acid lakes too, which complicate the mix. But for good reasons, we understood why, and we could show that with paleo they were naturally acid and why they were. So,
and one of the things we were talking about as we went through this was the Journal of Paleolimnology. And when we first started, we were trying to figure out kind of when paleolimnology as a discipline came together. And it's obviously you have to have a science before you can have a journal. And we thought, we didn't have a lot of information about the beginning of the journal when it first was put together, but you were there. I mean, it was you, right? So were any of the acid rain papers published in JOPL, or did the journal come after it sort of solidified there? I mean, the early ones, like the Perla papers. And
yeah, some of the early Perla papers, especially in volume 3. I mean, I was there as the first editor. It's a pretty young guy, but the history, yes, it was definitely coalescing enough that Springer, Springer's gone through various name changes, but it's, what is Springer now? Or Springer Nature now, or Nature, yeah, Springer Nature, they changed names, but it was Springer, the same people in the Netherlands, but primarily in the Netherlands. And yes, it moved, acid rain was one of the things that I think pushed the group together. Many of the early papers were published in the Journal of Paleomology. And I think that was I felt very strongly as the founding editor that it was a way to coalesce the science, synthetic science, but to give it some bonding and so on and so forth. So I think that was, we were certainly coming together as a recognized discipline. We had already international meetings. They were fairly, different areas and different years apart. But at least once you get a journal, sort of, it actually sort of synthesizes the field into one area, gives you the opportunity of looking and, putting methodology that's very relevant to your field there, to putting review articles very relevant to your field. And not to exclude paleolimnology for other journals. That was never the goal, as I wrote in the opening editorial. It's to bring the science together.
So how does that actually happen, like starting a journal? Like who pitches who? Did you go to Springer? Did a group go to Springer? Did someone come to you? Like how does that even work?
So I had done a book, Diatoms and Lake Acidity, with the publisher. It was an edited book. It came out in mid-1980s. I was in my 20s. Maybe early 30s at that stage. No, I was in my 20s, I guess. Wow, going back in time now. Anyway, it was called Diatoms and Lake Acidity. You write about, let's say, 20 chapters of, you know, trying to synthesize how different areas have used diatoms and chrysophytes to some extent to reconstruct acid rain. And I guess that book did pretty well. And the person the publisher I was working with, out of the blue phones me and says, we have already made the decision. We're making the decision to start a new Journal of Paleolimnology. We'd like to ask you to be editor. And I said, what? I was totally stunned. I thought about it. I was basically just starting my career in some ways, you know, at that time. Well, I'm not starting, but I mean, I was 30 years old when the phone call came. So I thought about it for a while, talked to a few people, and I thought, yeah. I had no idea how much work I was getting into. The publishing, editing was a very different world then. In 1988, that was 19, you know, by the time the first edition, you know, it takes about a year or so to get the papers. I think it was 1988, I guess, the first papers came out. And that's where it is now.
And so then, would there be a similar flow for the deeper series in terms of getting the standard methods all in one place?
So the developments in paleoenvironmental research, which I am the series editors of, and originally was between Bill Ast and I, but now I'm the series editor. It again sort of started a bit like that. We decided that we needed to standardize the methodology. Bjorn Berglund had a book from 1986 that this big orange book that so many of us still have on our desk was a methodology for paleo environmental sciences. You know, there's a chapter on pollen, chapter on diatoms, and so on and so forth. But it was actually, things had quite changed since 1980. You know, the book, the date on is 1986, but a lot of it was, you know, it takes a while to get a book out. It was actually sort of missed some of many of the new methodologies that were coming out. And so, by the time it was 2000, 2001, you know, it was time to, you know, there was a lot of new methodologies. It ended up being 4-volume series of methodologies, trying to bring it together. So we have, you know, pull it down and this is how you do, here's a typical techniques for cladostria, for chironomids, for particle size analysis, for tephras, the list, well, we ended up filling 4 volumes. That did quite well. So, you know, they wanted to make it while it was going, they said, let's make this a book series. And that's, so now it's a book series. And there've been other methods. Like there's been one on the very large book by John Burks, was the lead editor on numerical techniques. There's one on ice cores. There's one on dendrochronology. They're everywhere. So again, I was a further coalescing of the science, if you like. That's kind of what, you know, if you want a science, you need to, you don't need, but you know, if you want to be a designated science, having a dedicated journal, having a dedicated book series, having standard methodologies, having international symposia with an international society behind it, I think it's pretty clear it's a pretty mature science and a pretty mature journal as well, the Journal of Paleolimnology. So that's a lot. It's all happened since the 1980s. that part of the process. So. Yeah. Which for you seems long away. For me, I'm going, it doesn't seem so long ago.
So out of all those things, you know, I guess so much has changed since you first heard the term paleolimnology for the first time. But what, does anything really stand out as like the biggest changes? Or is it just everything has changed so much that it's almost unrecognizable?
I think the respect the field has changed, I can tell you. I mean, if I... I can tell you that, you know what, I spend, and I'm not just me, the fewer earlier paleomology seems to spend almost their entire time defending the field that it works. And, you know, and I understand that. First of all, scientists are supposed to be critical. Secondly, if I told someone without knowing what's going on that I go in the middle of the lake and I put a tube in the middle of the lake, and from that tube, I'm going to look at stuff that died before, and I'm going to tell you how acid rain changed, or I think they were nuts. It sounds like I can think of 1,000 reasons why it shouldn't work. And I can still think of 1,000 reasons why it shouldn't work. However, there's 1,000,000 reasons why it does work, as opposed to 1,000 reasons that shouldn't work. And so it works. You know, I mean, it's not perfect, but nothing is perfect. So I think that's the analogy, is there's so many more things making it work as opposed to things that you can, well, what about mixing? What about, yeah, well, you know, in some places we'd have a mixing issue, some places we have a diagenesis issue. The simple reality is that in the vast, vast majority of examples, it works remarkably well, despite potential shortcomings. And that's not to say the other fields don't have shortcomings. You know, I get, you take one core and you give the whole history of the lake. And I say, well, yeah, I'm also a limnologist, not just a paleomologist, but it seems most of the limnology area, you go take one water sample in the middle of the lake and that you say what the phosphorus concentration is. You know, I mean, and it works. I'm not criticizing, but I'm not sure anything's that much different. I think we have pretty even a better case where the sediments are integrating throughout the entire water column, through the entire horizontal bases of the lake and so on and so forth. So, you know, I think, and we've checked variability repeatedly in at least simple lake basins. So, you know, I can think of hundreds of reasons why it shouldn't work, but the simple reality, it works, and it works very well. And it has gotten credibility. It's used in policy implications. You know, politicians certainly invite me and many other paleontologists to consult in ideas of how to set policy. I think both of you know how busy I am dealing with that side of things. I think that's important. I do it all the time because the reason we do the science is that someone uses it. If no one doesn't want to use it, it's probably not doing it. You know, it wouldn't be that maybe perhaps not that important.
Yeah. Okay. And I'm following through on that in terms of impacting policy. Like now as, you know, the current president of the Royal Society of the Academy of Science within the Royal Society of Canada, and you are meeting with politicians and consulting, you know, what is that? I guess not just what is that like, but also what can you say to people like, do you have any, I guess, suggestions or advice to anyone that might be listening of how to break out of the ivory tower a little bit and help, you know, how do you get your science to actually change the world, I guess, would be in a big, big picture way.
Well, I think the first step of a professional scientist is to get their work out to the other scientists in professional journals and stuff. I mean, I don't want to, if it's not published, it doesn't exist. So you can't use the, you know, if it's not published in peer review, the science isn't going to be used, at least not by used by credible people. So that part's certainly important. But you need to carve out the time to do public outreach and to try and get your, whoever is interested in what you're doing, get the information out there. And that includes talking to, we're limnologists, so talking to local lake groups. Since August, I've given 3 keynotes at local lake management societies, you know, the different Rideau Lake groups and so on and so forth. And that's just to the users, primarily cottagers or, you know, anglers who want to know about their lake. And I talk about their lake and stuff. So that's one way. I know something about their lake. I found out what their lake was like. Yes, algal blooms are increasing in your lake. Here's probably why. That's at one level, sort of the local level. But then moving on up throughout the decision-making tree, you know, try and also address, do your best, things like this podcast, or try to do anything you can to get the information out to the non-specialists. And and if, you know, if you are asked to speak at a school, I go everywhere from kindergarten onwards, do it. And so people know what you're doing and put it in a way that's meaningful to them. And there's a scientific publication, but there's also more a public release kind of publication or a podcast or web pages. We're on web pages on all our major projects, and those are used by schools. You know, we always get questions from, you know, high school students. I'm doing a project on this and I saw your web page. Can I talk to you? So it goes from that level onwards to the, you know, to the prime minister, basically, or the president of your country. So so I think, and the onus is on us to do it. We've done a pretty poor job of it up until recently. It's getting better, but university is getting better too. When I was a young professor, I was kind of alone. You know, I didn't have support from the university and going out in media. The media were phoning me. I didn't, you know. Now, well, universities have communications offices, media offices. You know, their goal is to get their professors and their students, staff out to the media, because they've realized there's something good to this. You know, we get publicity, we get relevancy, and so on and so forth. So now it's a little bit easier. Like they come in this direction, and that's what happened with the acid rain. I never phoned a journalist in my life. They'd be phoning, you know, and it would be sometimes harrowing, like, you know, because it was a contentious issue. And I get phone calls in my office as a young professor and say, we have on the line someone else already who doesn't believe in this. And we were told that you might have the opposite view. You're talking to some producer. We're going live in 10 seconds. Are you going to stay on the line? And then we're going live in 5, 4, 3, and on the line we have John Swole. You know? And, you know, I mean, that, some of it was ambush stuff. And but, you know, you stay on the line. You didn't say, no, I don't want to talk. But it's a very hard, and sometimes, you know, sometimes you wonder, should you talk? I've had this with climate change. I've had it with the debates, you know. The fact that we're having, quote, these debates on climate change in media, and a lot of the media agree with me now. It's just, I did a lot of that, as you both know. But the fact that we're debating says there's a debate. It's not a debate, you know. And let's talk. You know, there was a time, but you know, there's a dangerous trend. As I just did in an editorial, there was a time when people spent 30, 35 years studying a topic, were experts, and with some areas now, they're elites, and that's a very dangerous trend too, which we have to fight. But I think we have to give comprehensive, accessible answers to direct questions, and we shouldn't be scared of doing that. We should do it, and we have a responsibility to do it. If nothing else, by and large, most of the work we do is funded by taxpayers' money anyway, so at least give it back to the people who paid for it.
Thanks, John. Really appreciate you sharing your time with us today and providing some new insights into, you know, paleolimnology and what it was like to be there, as it was evolving through many, many steps. And it's been really interesting and really, really appreciate you taking the time.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
Perfect. And yeah, we'll try and get John on again. I mean, he sits on his computer and looks at Zoom probably 24 hours a day at the moment. Maybe next time, God willing, we'll be able to do this live in Kingston. I'll come down and bring the recording gear and we'll do this sitting around the table as opposed to at the computer. But no, thanks again.
Great. Thanks.
So there we go. That was a discussion with Professor John Small from Queen's University. World-renowned paleolimnologist, there's no doubt about that. And had some really interesting insights on a bunch of different topics, and including, I think, a lot of kind of cool points related to the policy implications and the linkage between science and policy. And I guess that's stuff that he's really working quite heavily on sort of at the moment.
Yeah. And it's interesting in that, you know, a lot of the stuff I've picked up over the years in conversations with him before, but one thing that kind of was a little bit of a curveball with me is just wrapping my head around the whole personal computer being the draw being purely initially a word processing tool more so than a statistical tool. I guess it's, you know, how much your perspective changes or you know the whole where you stand depends on where you sit kind of idea.
Yeah, and maybe not that different, I guess. What do you do most of the time you're at the computer now? Type. And so...
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. All right. So we did 4 episodes on history, interview with John as an epilogue, and I think it's time to check the mailbag.
Sounds like a plan.
There's nothing in the mailbag. But maybe
I had a hunch that might be the case.
Well, I think maybe this history of getting back to our roots. We're definitely open to any questions or feedback from anyone. If there's anything, any omissions that you think, or call us out on it, that'd be great. You can either send us an email at coreideaspodcast@gmail.com or contact us directly on Twitter, where our handle is
Core Ideas Paleo.
And until the next time, thank you for listening to Core Ideas. If you want to check out past episodes or blog posts on almost all the episodes, I'm almost caught up. Check out ajaziorski.ca/core ideas. Oh my goodness, I totally fluffed that.
Isn't it Core Ideas slash podcast?
Oh crap.
Go to the Twitter page. you'll find a link to it right there.
Coreideas.ajaziorski.ca.
There it is. Perfect. Well, we know we can search for something on the internet quickly, at least. That's
on the intertubes.
And he does some good blog posts on the actual material. So wherever they are, they're thorough. A lot of good information there. Well worth your time. And if nothing else, since Adam's still laughing / burying his head into his desk, thanks for listening. Hope you enjoyed this episode with John. And if you have any ideas for other guests, let us know. And if not, we'll catch you next time.
Bye.